The strength of a war fought without monetary reserves, wrote Francois Rabelais, is as fleeting as a breath. So is the strength of any other governmental activity. Without money, a government is helpless either to protect or to coerce. Those two government functions on which I have so far been concentrating my attention. Even more obviously, without money it cannot subsidize. It cannot represent itself as being an indulgent mother as well as a stern but protective father. Money, then, is as important to government as it is to the rest of us. Our own monetary resources, however, are distinctly limited. How far is this also true of governments? Governments have means of acquiring wealth which are not available to even the wealthiest of private individuals or corporations. The familiar comparison of government budgeting to household budgeting is absurd. If governments are running short, they can confiscate some of our money in taxes, they can print more money. If we were to do either of these things, we should be put in jail. Only in rare instances are governments reduced to penury, when their money is so worthless or their taxes so high that their citizens resort to barter and their international credit is totally exhausted. Well before that point, however, they can be so situated that they can neither increase taxes, nor borrow, nor print more money without producing social and economic consequences which they will wish to avoid, which will alienate their supporters and strengthen the position of their opponents. To that degree, their resources are limited, as the Whitlam government discovered to its cost. Libertarians would like to restrict government still more closely. They would like to see taxation cut and governments compelled not only to balance their budgets, but to live within constitutionally determined limits. They have four reasons for saying this. First, they argue, governments are wasteful precisely because it is not the government, but the taxpayer, who has to pay. Secondly, their borrowings can provoke inflation and their taxation can reduce the volume of productive investment. Thirdly, to spend, governments have to enlarge the bureaucracy and thereby to withdraw still further resources from the community. Fourthly, their spending diminishes the strength of such socially central moral qualities as self-reliance. These are all of them serious objections, not likely to be dismissed. Before we advocate any form of government expenditure, we should certainly ask ourselves not only whether it is likely to produce the ends we have in mind, but whether it is the most economical way of doing so, keeping in mind the social costs to which the libertarian draws attention: wastefulness, taxation, bureaucratic expansion, the weakening of independence. What are the proper limits to the ways in which governments can spend our money? Only the anarchist, for whom the very existence of governments is an affront, will deny that governments can properly use the taxes we pay for some kinds of protection and coercion. The only controversial issue is what kinds of protection and coercion. Subsidization is a different matter, for the libertarian denies that governments have any right to subsidize at all, not merely that they have any right to subsidize this or that particular activity. Subsidies, they say, are immoral, unnecessary, ineffective, and dangerous. Let us look at these charges in turn. First, the charge that subsidies are immoral. In our society, subsidies take a great many different forms. The use of superphosphates can be subsidized by a bounty, the manufacture of motor cars by tariffs, the performance of grand opera by subsidies through a grant-giving body. The general justification for subsidies is, however, the same in each case, that there is some form of desirable activity which, without government help, would disappear or be greatly attenuated. But the only proof that something is desirable, so the libertarian argues, is that people actually desire it. If they desire a form of activity to be continued or strengthened, they should be prepared to support it out of their own pocket. As it is, money is taken from taxpayers by the government in order to subsidise activities by methods which inevitably involve all the social costs I have already enumerated, and which the taxpayer would not be prepared financially to support if the money had been left in his own pocket. And it is completely immoral, so the libertarian contends, for governments to take money from Peter in order to subsidise Paul. About the basic facts, there can be no dispute. Governments often spend our money on supporting activities which we should not support ourselves and may even regard with hostility. I doubt whether there is a single one of us who accepts as being desirable every governmental subsidy, whether to the car industry, or to private schools, or to farmers, or to the theatre. You can enlarge the list for yourself. That is bound to happen whenever a government accepts the principle of subsidisation, given that there are such marked differences of opinion about what kinds of activity are so desirable that they deserve subsidy. But it is naive to conclude that governments therefore act immorally in subsidising, that this is some kind of theft. For something similar is true in the case of other government activities. There will be some taxpayers who would not themselves spend a penny on defence. Any of us can well oppose, and are perfectly entitled to express our opposition to, particular acts of coercion, just as we can express our hostility to particular acts of subsidisation. When we elect a government, however, we expect it to exercise certain kinds of power and to sustain or work towards a particular type of society. We can acquiesce in its being obliged in order to do this to subsidise. We can accept the inevitable consequence that it will sometimes subsidise what we wish it would not subsidise. We freely give it money with which to subsidise. It is not forcibly taken from us. If we had to make the decisions a government makes for us, to spend a few cents here, a few cents there, this would be enormously time-consuming. But even if we reject the view that subsidisation is immoral, we have still to consider the accusation that subsidies are unnecessary, ineffective, and dangerous. I shall look particularly, in the light of libertarian criticisms, at the subsidising of art, scholarship, and science. This for two reasons. First, because I have some practical experience of its effects, both as a distributor and a recipient of subsidies, and secondly, because it draws attention to the points in dispute in a particularly striking way. In the case of science, one might defend subsidies by a rather special argument. Science sometimes has practical applications which are totally unforeseen. Just because these results cannot be foreseen, it would be unreasonable to expect any particular industrial enterprise to subsidise the activities which lead to them. New drugs are now mostly discovered, no doubt, in pharmaceutical laboratories, privately owned. The costs inherent in such discoveries, the companies are prepared to meet. But one could not reasonably have expected them to support what has been the great scientific breakthrough, the techniques of recombinant biology. This is in itself a sound argument. What it brings out is that it is sometimes desirable for a community to support scientific research, which it would be irrational for any particular industrial enterprise to support. Preventive medicine is a clear instance. No particular industry is likely to gain financially from discoveries in preventive medicine. Some will lose, with additional cost to face if it is discovered that their products or the processes of manufacturing them actually create disease. Yet from the point of view of the community at large, preventive medicine can be of enormous importance. If this argument suggests that it can be necessary, and certainly not immoral, to subsidise some forms of scientific research, it is not strong enough, however, as a basis for the conclusion that science should be subsidised on the scale to which it has recently become accustomed, even on the very low Australian scale. Unexpected as the results of scientific work often are, we can be pretty confident that the sole interest of a great deal of the scientific work being done in Australia is purely intellectual. If nothing is at issue but practical results, we also have to meet the objection that except in relation to a small number of investigations of purely Australian interest, we should buy all our science-based technology from overseas. We already buy most of it. Would we be worse off as a country if we were to follow that policy quite generally, leaving painting, literature, the theatre to commercial management, importing overseas theatrical companies, abandoning scholarship, except on Australian themes, along with science? We have never in our history quite reached that point, but we came uncomfortably close to it in that dreadful Australia in which I grew up. We should then be a country which imaginative people simply left, as they did in the great exodus of the post-war years, as they still do, to a striking but still lesser degree. I suppose that there are those among us who would be wholly content with a society without diversity, lacking originality, without imaginativeness, which would be entirely parasitic for what culture it has on the wider world. This is the Australia, indeed, which even now many of our overseas critics take to be the actual Australia, expressing surprise or even indignation, for no one likes to have his stereotypes shattered, that anyone with even a modicum of ability should continue to live here. It is my hope, however, that the number of Australians who would be content to live in a society which had no artists, no scientists, no writers, no thinkers, is now relatively small, even if in my nightmares I see that number increasing rather than further diminishing. And I do not see how, without government help, artists, scientists, writers could survive. They have always needed help, whether in the form of a private income, like such great scientists as Boyle, Cavendish, Darwin, or jobs which took a very small part of their time, like old-style clergymen or old-style diplomats or old-style civil servants, or the patronage of church or aristocracy. Governments have simply taken over as these other forms of support have vanished. It can be by no means presumed that if they withdrew their support, private enterprise would fill the gaps. The Elizabethan Theatre Trust was originally set up to attract business patronage to the arts. In that it failed almost completely. What it succeeded in doing was to attract government subsidies for the first time in Australia. But is government patronage ineffective? I said earlier that people cannot be coerced into being imaginative. Imaginativeness, it is also true, cannot be created by spending money. That is one clear limitation on the government's power to subsidise art and science. It cannot by that means guarantee imaginative achievements. The Swedish film industry is abundantly subsidised. Yet over the last decade, not a single new filmmaker of importance has come from that country, and what seemed to be promising talents have run to sand. The extraordinarily generous subsidisation of German theatre has produced some interesting productions, but few, if any, playwrights of major importance. It is widely recognised that artistic genius is unpredictable, but governments often find it hard to believe that in science, at least, public expenditure will not necessarily lead to immediate results, that they cannot, by spending enough money, dispel that veil of ignorance which so limits them. After all, they're inclined to say to themselves, as President Carter obviously did, money put a man on the moon, why shouldn't it cure cancer? This attitude is strengthened when scientists or science-based technologists themselves put a definite date on discoveries, as has several times happened in the case of nuclear fusion. That creates the impression that scientific and technological innovation is just a matter of routine procedure. Some science, some technology is of this sort. Given the money, results can almost be guaranteed by applying familiar procedures in an area where the basic factors are already known. But the sort of innovative science, innovative thinking, innovative technology which Australia so badly needs is not of this kind. These facts, however, are not strong enough to support the view that subsidisation is ineffective. It cannot guarantee the emergence of genius, but it can assist in the maintenance of a general level of achievement, out of which, with luck, fruitful innovations will arise, along with, inevitably, a great deal of rubbish. I believe that it has had that effect in Australia. But what about the view that subsidization is actually dangerous? Well, it can be. Too much money can be as bad as too little. In the theatre, it can give rise to productions which are grandiose rather than genuinely imaginative. I have heard it argued in Germany that subsidized costly productions have not only failed to raise the level of German drama, but have actually lowered it, smothering the writer beneath stage effects. Governments tend to favour the established and the grandiose, as notably in the Soviet Union. That is no novelty. In the past, aristocratic patrons or the church often had the same taste for the grandiose, the same tendency to support already established figures. But it is not universally true that what the government builds, let us say, will be pretentiously boring. Some of the best buildings in Australia were built by the New South Wales government architect. The most that can be said is that government subsidy, even when it sets out with completely different aspirations, tends to move in the direction of supporting established figures or the more spectacular forms of art like opera and ballet. It is easier for a subsidising body to deal with established individuals, established theatre companies. There is less chance that they will produce nothing at all or something completely worthless. Their large-scale activities are politically more conspicuous than the minor and imperfect creations of a beginner. Only very rarely will a politician, as in Mr. Whitlam's case, be personally interested in the more experimental kinds of theatre. There are excellent reasons, then, why governments should not intervene directly in the distribution of subsidies. But these reasons do not apply with the same strength when, as is in fact the normal Australian habit, grants are given by government-financed but quasi-independent bodies, for example, the Australia Council. Even they, however, can of course be profoundly affected by the nature of the appointments which governments make to them and their perception of changes in the general atmosphere of the government which is financing them. A second danger can arise from a government's tendency to want immediate results, an attitude which also can filter through to grant-giving bodies. Some American scientists suggest that as a direct result of the way in which government subsidies are now managed, we are living on our resources of fundamental science rather than replacing them. Subsidizing bodies, anxious in a time of cutbacks to illustrate the immediate usefulness of what they are doing, demand, according to such critics, short-term investigations from which results, even if they're rather routine results, can be confidently expected. The only hope, such critics argue, now lies in large corporations, which find it easier to be patient than do governments. I do not know whether the facts bear out such criticisms. Scientists can never be wholly trusted when what is at issue is money for their research. But this is certainly a tendency in contemporary society, a tendency which affects both government and private enterprise, to be obsessed with the immediate, with quick results, quick profits, rapid exploitation, a tendency aggravated by high interest rates. To take another instance, and this is not at all irrelevant to the question whether authors should be subsidized, publishers who were once happy with books of a serious character, which would sell small quantities over long periods, many important books of every sort, both literary and technical, fall into this category, now look for trivial but topical books which will sell rapidly and can then be rapidly remainded. In Australia, the short-term emphasis is particularly obsessive, as if we were living on borrowed time. We are a nation of gamblers, not of long-term investors. Our motto is small outlays for quick results. Our national symbol ought to be a lottery ticket, not the contemplative and abstemious koala. It would seem shocking to many a foreigner, but natural to an Australian, that lotto tickets are on sale within Parliament House itself, in its post office. It is politically very difficult in such circumstances for a government to adopt a long-term attitude when it is subsidising, even if it wants to. Where journalists, politicians, general public will rapidly ask, are the results? A more serious question is whether subsidy is dangerous, insofar as by a natural transition it leads to control. Government servants are often suspicious of organisations which distribute public funds, but which are not subject to the constant auditing which is characteristic of governmental organizations. They may urge upon their political masters the need for more intimate control by some government department, a control which will at the same time, of course, extend their own power. Many of our social evils arise from this sort of imperialism, whether it is displayed by bureaucrats, by academics, by trade union leaders, or by entrepreneurs of the Rupert Murdoch variety. The battle cry of accountability is raised, as it was by Harold Wilson in his pronouncement that the grasp of national control must extend as far as the reach of government aid. Although, interestingly enough, in Australia this cry comes more often from conservative than from Labour politicians. Conservatives who do not realise that they are paving the way to the sort of direct control beloved by doctrinaire socialists. A group of technologically based industries with a better understanding of science than government accountants ever possess have jointly protested in public advertisements against the demand of the American government that subsidized scientists should account for every minute of their day, in the face of the familiar fact that scientists often get their best ideas shaving or fishing or talking over coffee. This is one of the ways, by a transition from subsidy to control over the entire life of creative imagination, that totalitarianism is most likely to creep upon us. The libertarian is right about this. It would not be issued in by wicked men, not by fanatics, but by sensible, virtuous, well-intentioned individuals with orderly minds. These are the people most dangerous to the creative imagination as a result of their total incapacity to understand how it works. They will point out quite correctly that organisations run by or on behalf of imaginative people are not always ideal in their presentation of accounts, that they have a strong tendency to overrun their budgets, that those whom they subsidise do not always show proper gratitude or do precisely what they have committed themselves to doing. The relation between patron and artist has never been an easy one. It is scarcely surprising that government officials should prefer routine intellectuals and artists who can be relied upon to produce routine results. I said that by a natural transition, subsidy can turn into direct government control. Well, what is wrong, a socialist would argue, with direct government control? Obviously, it has dangers for liberty. But is it also bound to be inefficient? Libertarians do not deny that governments can control organisations. They do deny that governments can ever run them well. Here is a typical example from the American libertarian philosopher John Hospers, one-time libertarian candidate for the American presidency. If you have ever stood at the post office with a dozen people in line and one man working behind the counter and 15 postal employees moving about doing nothing in particular and not caring whether the customers are served or not, or if you've ever waited half an hour at the registry office while the staff who were supposed to be serving you telephoned their girlfriends, sublimely unperturbed by the line of waiting people, you have seen the typical government agency at work. The American Post Office is the favourite libertarian example. Milton Friedman, too, makes great use of it. And indeed, I have sometimes toyed with the idea that this remarkable institution is deliberately designed as a demonstration that government institutions are bound to be inefficient. But our own Post Office was at one time an extremely efficient organisation. Indeed, there is often more to be feared from the ability, the efficiency of civil servants than from their inefficiency. It is interesting to note, however, that such criticisms of government-run organisations are by no means peculiar to American libertarians. More and more socialists look to Yugoslavia rather than to the Soviet Union as their ideal, to a society, that is, in which, or so such socialists suppose, organisations are run by the workers, rather than directed from above by centralised government planning operating through government officials. Their admiration is in spite of the fact that Yugoslavia suffers from both inflation and unemployment, often supposed to be characteristic scourges only of capitalist countries. Are we to agree, then, that this constitutes a limit on government, that there are some things it cannot do well, however hard it tries, including the running of organisations which attempt to serve the public? Hospers offers two explanations of the post office's inefficiency. The first is that the post office is spending the public's money so that it has no incentive to be efficient. The second is that it has a monopoly, so that we cannot take our business elsewhere if we are dissatisfied with it. These, of course, are commonplace explanations, but how far are they justified? Not surprisingly, hospice does not think in terms of that favourite Australian pattern in which private and governmental enterprise compete. In such a situation, the government does not have a monopoly, so we cannot blame any defects government activities might have on their monopoly position. We might happily agree that where there is monopoly, public or private, this indifference to the public can easily arise, and that a public nationalised organisation is likely to be worse than a private monopoly just because the private monopoly has still to fear the emergence of a competitor or a government takeover. Where there is competition between them, it is by no means plain that the private enterprise always provides better service than its government competitor. Many people choose the public enterprise for reasons which are anything but ideological. But a monopolistic, wholly nationalised service nearly always has a characteristic defect. In Europe, the governmental railway systems are often superb, considered as technical achievements. But one could travel 100 kilometres or more in the time it takes to make a reservation or to obtain information, which often turns out to be misinformation. The same weakness at the front desk in dealing with individual cases has often been noted in respect to the government service in Australia. One remembers the Hungarian Marxist, Hegedűs, describing the bureaucrat, for whom, he says, the general public consists of strange outsiders, malevolent even, who are incapable of understanding the solemn rituals of administrators, who have to be treated, therefore, with a mixture of suspicion and disdain. If such attitudes are not unique to the government service, they certainly flourish there. The solicitude of government, wrote Wilhelm von Humboldt in The Limits of Government as long ago as 1812, must be harmful insofar as it has to operate upon a promiscuous mass of individualities and therefore does harm to them by measures that cannot meet individual needs. The socialist answer is to abolish the individualities. The libertarian answer is to abolish the solicitude of government. Those of us who hope to retain, indeed to intensify individuality, while not being prepared to entrust every form of solicitude to voluntary organisations, will need to think very hard indeed how this can possibly be done. So much is clear. Such a balance depends on a delicate interplay between the private and the public, between governmental and voluntary organisations. But that interplay can only with difficulty be sustained. The temptation to choose a simpler sounding way out of our problems is very strong indeed. Government has two faces. One face is severe, unbending, insisting on our duties. The other face, the protective face, mingles sternness with benevolence. Which expression government bears when it looks at us will depend on its intentions and our actions. In the last lecture, we contemplated the coercive face. Let us now look at the protective face, the face which still displays the sternness of coercion, but in a form mitigated by a degree of concern, concern for us as persons, for our activities, for our rights. Only because it thus protects us, so the philosopher Thomas Hobbes argued, are we prepared to submit to the coercion of government. The very same instruments of government, we should observe, police, army, inspectors, may be used both to protect and to coerce. For the anarchist, as we saw, the protective face is hypocritical. The only genuine face of government is coercive. The libertarian finds the protective face at least as threatening as the coercive face, threatening to our independence, except when it is confined to protection against violence and the protection of contractual relations. Against what can a government protect its citizens? In the first place, so everyone would agree, against external enemies. The Soviet Union's ability to sustain in its citizens a siege mentality is a principal source of its power. Not so very long ago as in Machiavelli's Florence, the ruler had to be a great warrior. Indeed, Hitler, Stalin, Churchill all thought of themselves as versed in the art of generalship, even if, unlike their predecessors, they did not themselves lead troops into battle. That has not been our Australian tradition. We do not expect Mr. Fraser to head a trail bike division, as rulers once led cavalry charges. Nevertheless, we still expect our governments to defend us. Unless they can do so, indeed, they will either be conquered, overthrown by their own citizens, or reduced to the status of satellite puppets. The two central defensive powers are military force and diplomacy. As in its relationships with hostile powers in its own community, a government displays its diplomatic statesmanship by its capacity to negotiate without derogating from its own authority. Its diplomatic relations with its allies can be no less delicate and sensitive than its relations with potential aggressors. It has to play a three-handed game for enormous stakes, and it may hold very few trump cards. What cards it holds will depend in large part on such uncontrollable factors as its size, its location, its resources. But even superpowers, for all their advantages in size, location, and resources, cannot guarantee the total protection of their citizens. Indeed, if they go in search of total security, they often get themselves into a position in which they are increasing rather than diminishing the likelihood of war. The United States and the Soviet Union are now so placed in relation to one another that they are no longer capable of effectively negotiating. They have no option but to try to meet each weapon with a counterweapon, even although the only possible outcome is either economic exhaustion or a totally destructive war, destructive beyond any human imagination in comparison with which Hiroshima or Nagasaki is but a child dropping its toy. If governments are thus limited in their capacity to defend their citizens against external enemies, what about their power to defend them against their fellow citizens, against crime? Governments have a number of instruments at their disposal for this purpose: legislation, the judiciary, the police, the power to initiate social change, education, forms of social care. Among these powers, legislation plays a somewhat peculiar role in virtue of its capacity to create or abolish crimes at the stroke of a pen, by, let us say, decriminalising the smoking of marijuana or criminalising the drinking of alcohol. To ask, then, what a government can do against crime is confusing insofar as it implicitly suggests that there is a fixed entity, crime, which a government has to confront. Crime consists of what a government counts as such. Of course, it is not wholly free in respect to what it counts as crime. It may not be able to criminalise the drinking of alcohol, to decriminalise the smoking of marijuana, without arousing the hostility of its supporters or strengthening its powerful opponents. One cannot imagine a society legalising rape, killing, burglary, although it may permit or even encourage such acts in time of war or as an instrument of governmental coercion. Let us begin, then, from this last class of cases in which the government can rely upon universal support. Not even the criminal argues that there should be no laws against killing, rape, burglary. Simply, he does not observe them. Yet even in this favourable case, no government can expect to be wholly effective in protecting its citizens, at least so long as it allows them the least degree of liberty. Japan, where one can safely walk the streets at night, has a considerable homicide rate in spite of the degree of police surveillance which there prevails. It could be diminished, a Japanese police officer recently remarked, only by hiding a policeman behind every bush. We may find it surprising that even in the case of actions which are universally regarded as crimes, as distinct from actions which many citizens do not regard as such, like the smoking of marijuana, powerful governments should be so ineffective that they cannot even prevent violent crime from increasing sharply, let alone wipe it out. In the United States, many citizens have so little confidence in the power of the government to protect them that they still demand the right to carry arms. There is some reason to believe that we are moving in the same direction. We have already witnessed a striking increase in the number of private security guards and in surveillance by in-house television, a phenomenon which I remember first encountering with horror in the United States not so very long ago. The police regularly suggest that women should not go out alone at night and that we should all live behind barred doors. The idea that we should be able to live our lives in an atmosphere largely free from suspicion, that the government, not private police, should be able to protect property, seems to have been abandoned as utopian, as if the most government could hope to do, and then very imperfectly, was to catch criminals after they have acted. Why should this be so? There is no shortage of suggested answers. Libertarians tell us that governments have interfered in too many areas which are simply no part of their business. If governments would confine themselves to their proper business of protecting life and property, they would have the resources they need for that purpose. In particular, governments have tried to protect their citizens not only against the violence of others, but against their own moral weakness. And this, libertarians would argue, is not only grossly improper, but impossible. If, no doubt, a government can demonstrate that the use of a drug, in and of itself, leads individuals to commit crimes against others, then it is entitled to prohibit the use of that drug, but not otherwise. By entirely withdrawing from attempts to control except by persuasion, drug-taking, prostitution, the like, a government, so libertarians argue, would at once reduce the corruption and violence which attempts to control them inevitably generate, and would have the resources available for its proper business of protecting its citizens against violence. They point to American prohibition as the most striking example of the manner in which the attempt to prevent citizens from engaging in activities which they do not regard as criminal encouraged, first, the rise of organized crime, and secondly, the emergence of a general attitude that there was nothing so bad, after all, in law-breaking. The authoritarian answer is very different. The laws, the authoritarian would say, are simply not enforced with sufficient rigour. Penalties are too low and too uncertain. Too many criminals are found innocent on technical grounds. Thanks to the lawyers, justice is no longer swift and speedy. The courts are clogged with delaying actions. So punishment does not have either the certainty or the immediacy that it needs in order to be effective. The social reformer takes still another view, that the only way to reduce the crime rate is to attack the social conditions which lie at its roots, whether these be unemployment, racial discrimination, inferior schooling, or what you will. And then there is a wide range of miscellaneous answers. The television, not only by in its programs normalizing crime, but by its mere existence, emptying the streets, isolating parents from children, neighbour from neighbour, is the real villain, or that women going to work is the source of our troubles, or children being given too much pocket money, or the emphasis of advertisers on instant satisfaction, or the imitation by our police of American methods, for all their proven ineffectiveness, instead of remaining on the beat. Or, and by no means finally, that the increasing crime rate is simply a product of the rise in the number of young people in the age that is most given to crime, from 15 to 25. This is yet another example of the problems governments have to confront. Problems arising out of the fact that on the one side, we actually know very little about the causes of social changes, how to produce them, why they come about, and on the other side, that many of the government's most powerful supporters and more vigorous opponents are convinced that they do have this knowledge. It is not unlikely that each and every one of the factors I have mentioned plays some part in increasing the rate of violent crime. The changes in respect to any one of them would chip away at the crime rate. It is highly unlikely that any one of them is the sole cause of the increasing crime rate. Suppose, however, that we could agree that, let us say, the abolition of television would reduce the crime rate. could we imagine a government criminalising television, or sending all young people to a concentration camp for 10 years until they come out of the dangerous age? It is very likely that the decriminalisation of drug taking would considerably reduce the incidence of violent crime. But governments are extremely reluctant to take that step. The libertarian is right enough. The number of criminals can be reduced by reducing the number of acts that are counted as crimes. But that serious crime would diminish in a libertarian society based on the principle of every man for himself is by no means so apparent. There can scarcely be a better illustration of the limits of government and the variety of circumstances from which those limits can arise. From ignorance, from the presence in the community of powerful groups, often moralistic, whom the government cannot offend, from the need not to alienate its supporters, from the attitude of the police force itself, who are often more hostile to those who seek their pleasures in unorthodox ways than to the housebreaker, from social traditions like our own, which ascribe a special social value to the consumption of alcohol and to the demonstration of masculinity. There are many other things which a government may attempt either to protect or to protect against. It can protect, in the first place, individual rights, whether those very general rights which all citizens possess, or the more specific rights which they derive from their having been injured in some respect, or having entered into a particular contract, or possessing particular kinds of property in the broader sense of the word property. Of this sort of protection, the libertarian particularly approves. The first sort of right, the very general rights which derive from citizenship and which consist in essence of rights against arbitrary government, is sometimes constitutionally guaranteed. So the set of amendments to the American Constitution, which are collectively described as the Bill of Rights, lay it down in their first article that Congress shall make no law which prohibits the exercise of religion, or limits the freedom of speech or the press, or the right of the people to assemble peaceably. No such rights are written into our Constitution. The Founding Fathers decided otherwise. Whether they ought to be is a much disputed question. In the long run, the crucial element is the determination of the courts to sustain both these and more particular rights. A government can destroy the power of the courts to do so. In many revolutions, the first step of the revolutionary government is to destroy the judicial system. When Shakespeare put into the mouth of the revolutionary Jack Cade, "The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers," he gave expression to what has been a common revolutionary sentiment. People's courts after revolutions have replaced formal tribunals. Revolutionary dictates have replaced regular laws. Revolutionary courts take it as their function to protect not individual rights, but some general concept like the revolution, the people, or the state. But that attitude does not last. It is the essence of government by terror, in which nobody knows where he stands from moment to moment, the government by terror so vividly described in Kafka's The Trial. Laws which lay down specific rights which the government will protect, open trials, the right to confront witnesses, none of these can be set aside as some of our Western Marxists set them aside, as merely a means of protecting the property of the bourgeoisie. Eastern European socialists have come to recognise that fact, to be somewhat perturbed indeed by the degree to which their laws correspond to the laws of capitalist and pre-capitalist societies, given the Marxist presumption that when a bourgeois government talks about protecting rights, it can only mean protecting the rights of the owners of the means of production. The only crucial point for my present purposes is this. The judicial system is not merely a system of coercion. It is a principal mechanism for protecting rights. By maintaining its independence, by doing what it can to ensure that justice is available to all, not merely to the wealthy, and is not subject to intolerable delays, by legislating so as to make rights clear and determinant, a government can do a great deal to protect individual rights, if also, of course, by coercion, it can destroy rights. The major form of protection expected from a modern government, however, is neither protection of citizens against other citizens, nor such other important forms of protection as the protection of the environment against citizens, but the protection of citizens against the effects of accident, penury, illness, unemployment. It is at this point that the battle rages most fiercely. The libertarian would have governments withdraw, wholly or largely, from this type of protection. The proponent of the welfare state argues that governments should extend still further their protective mantle. The more radical social reformer takes the view that governments have the responsibility of abolishing unemployment, as distinct from merely protecting against its effects, and that even illness can be largely reduced by appropriate government action. To some of the questions central to this dispute, we shall return in the next lecture. These are problems arising out of any government's financial limitations and the methods of subsidy and administration peculiar to it. These set aside, how can a government protect against human ills? It is plain in the first place that it cannot make its citizens happy, even if the name welfare state might suggest otherwise. But it can remove some of the sources of unhappiness by protecting its citizens against some of the effects of misfortune. A great deal will depend on how it does this. Take the case of old age. How far can a government protect against the effects of old age? Obviously, it cannot abolish old age, as it might conceivably be able, in principle, to abolish all but temporary unemployment. It cannot give the elderly love, either. It cannot replace the friends that the elderly have lost, the loved ones who have died or drifted away from them. It is faced, too, with a political difficulty. The aged, the physically handicapped, the insane, the chronically or mortally ill, the unemployed, share one characteristic. They are all of them extremely unpopular. Their very existence is resented. They are seen as a burden. They are feared as exemplifying a fate which any of us may have to endure, but which we prefer as far as possible to forget. This is especially so in Australia, where, for example, we hear a great deal about the burden imposed by the elderly on the taxpayer, even though the elderly form a much smaller part of the population than in other industrialised countries. Their pensions are both small and rigorously means-tested, and they are offered, unlike the young, very few concessions by private and public organisations alike. In much of Europe and in the United States, the elderly as such, independent of their income, can travel by train at half price, have cheap admission to films, just like the young here. Such concessions are especially important insofar as they help to keep the elderly interested in life, active, subject to fresh impressions. And it is now generally agreed that this is an important way of reducing the incidence of senility. It reduces the likelihood that the elderly will have to go to nursing homes. It helps to reduce their loneliness, to maintain their independence. And that suggests an important principle. Governments, with the help of voluntary organisations and private enterprise, can protect in ways that encourage independence, as distinct from protecting in ways which encourage dependence. Both humanitarian and purely economic considerations suggest that this is the best path to take, whether in relation to the elderly, the handicapped, the unemployed, or the aborigines. As it is, through our attitudes to the youthful unemployed or underemployed, whether they are brilliant young scientists and scholars or unskilled labourers, we are creating a rod that will someday beat our backs. The young, let us not forget, are always the stormtroopers of fanaticism, whatever form that fanaticism may take, even if the intellectual leadership always comes from their elders. The libertarians make many criticisms of the welfare state. Apart from their characteristic unwillingness to spend money on anybody but themselves, they see the welfare state as diminishing personal liberty. There can be no doubt that it often does. If it entirely concentrates on the relief of suffering, in itself, of course, an important function, rather than on the maintenance of independence, we could end up with a society in which a large segment of the population is wholly dependent upon government, in which the government is able to bully, maltreat, invade privacy, display meanness, inhumanity, with nothing to protect those it maltreats except a public opinion which is largely uninterested, often resentful, averting its eyes from what happens until a scandal breaks, behaving, in short, like respectable Germans in Nazi Germany. The comparison of some of our worst asylums, our worst nursing homes, to the less murderous of the concentration camps is by no means merely fanciful. It is not true, I have, however, been suggesting, that a government can protect against misfortune only by encouraging dependence. It can, at least in principle, encourage independence. Can, for example, abolish the disgracefully immoral practice of compulsory retirement. It can be more interested in encouraging the handicapped, the elderly, the chronically ill, the unemployed, to earn what little income they can, than by engaging in constant inspection to make sure that they do not. We pay altogether too much attention to the occasional bludger, too little to the need for encouraging effort and independence. More positively, a government can encourage the elderly, the chronically ill, the handicapped, to maintain their independence by household aids, training in schools, the provision of public transport, and the like. These are all of them things which, subject to political constraints, governments can do, if they can also, with perhaps less public opposition, sweep the elderly, the handicapped, the insane into asylums, nursing homes, hospitals, and the unemployed into oblivion or contumely. Even if humanity and economics, as I said, lead to the same conclusion, the obstacles, unfortunately, are the most powerful obstacles of all. Fear, prejudice, ignorance, jealousy, envy, and meanness. This is a very large theme which I have inadequately explored. About one other form of protection, consumer protection, I should like to say a little. It is not entirely new. The protection of individuals against faulty weights and measures has a relatively long history. As my colleague Professor McDonough has shown, consumer protection provoked one of the first instances in the 1820s of government intervention in contracts to protect immigrant passengers, wholly ignorant about the voyage which lay before them, against avaricious ship owners. But it has multiplied in recent years. The libertarian objects. He wants us to return to the old principle, caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. Even in the case of pharmaceutical products, the libertarian argues that the long delays in introducing new drugs, the refusal to permit the sale of many other drugs, has in fact been responsible for more deaths and illnesses than would have resulted from a less rigorous policy or even a free-for-all. A well-established retail organization, an industry, a pharmaceutical organization, does not wish, the libertarian continues, to lose its goodwill. It will protect the consumer against shoddy goods. If it does not, some other firm will take the business away from it. What libertarians have written on this issue, however, is very much the product of middle-class intellectuals. Such people, unlike the poor, are not always in search of a way of buying on the cheapest market. They can afford to go to the better shops. Unlike the Spanish poor, they are unlikely to buy olive oil mixed with used motor oil from street peddlers and suffer the consequence in death from pneumonia. Furthermore, they can cope with information. They are likely very quickly to become aware of the dangers inherent in particular products. They may subscribe to consumers or to motor journals. They have friends who will tell them whom to go to if they are in search of a doctor or a lawyer. They do not think for a moment of that very considerable section of the public for whom the warnings, the instructions on a bottle or a package are totally meaningless, either because they cannot read at all, cannot read English, or cannot understand the language in which it is couched. It is clear that no government can wholly protect us against our own folly, our incompetence, or our carelessness. It is also clear that on the other side, it can prohibit practices which make these mistakes on our part less calamitous or less probable. But the libertarian is right to this degree. If a government goes in search of some sort of absolute security, if it tries to construct a world in which we cannot possibly suffer as a result of our carelessness, our ignorance, our stupidity, it is attempting the impossible. The ingenuity of bureaucrats, especially in the United States, has reached extraordinary limits in seeking out ways in which products could be dangerous, as if we were to prohibit large dictionaries on the ground that if you drop them, they can break your toes. The libertarian revolt is so far intelligible. Such bureaucratic regulation can create a society so controlled that there is no room in it for imagination, for risk-taking. For these are always dangerous qualities, dangerous to those who possess them, to their fellow citizens, and above all, to governments. There is no total security short of the grave. Security, considered as a final aim, is, as my old teacher John Anderson used to argue, at once unattainable and ignoble.